Thanks for joining us. My name is Ibrahim Sani. We are taping this conversation at the corridors of Kuala Lumpur Convention Center. This is because we are attending the Hasanah Forum or the AVPN Conference 2023. Astrawani is the official broadcaster for this conference. Over the past few days, we've been speaking to some luminaries, including Professor Dr. Jack Sim of World Toilet Organization. It was his and his organization's efforts that we created the World Toilet Day, celebrated every November 19th. We also spoke to the Managing Director of Khazanah National, Dato' Amirul Faisal, on impact investing. We spoke with Dato' Shahira Bazari of Yayasan Hasanah, talking about social responsibility and social returns investment. And we spoke about Dana impact and how investments into this space is actually quite crucial. So you can catch all these conversations on astrawani.com. However, there is one conversation that I find very interesting, which is on set with me right now, Roshwini Enfais Mutia, the manager of Prospect Research of Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiatives Southeast Asia. Quite a mouthful, but it was a chance meeting that I met Roshwini of DNDI at the corridors here having coffee. Let's talk about what DNDI is all about, because I find this quite interesting as well.
Oh, hi. Okay, thank you, Ibrahim. That was a very interesting introduction. So DNDI is based in Geneva. It is a PDP. It is a product development partnership. So they work with governments, they work with private partnerships, it's multi-stakeholder, and it's end-to-end on medical R&D research. So we want to produce and develop drugs that are affordable and very accessible for countries that face neglected tropical diseases. And we also now focus on neglected patients as well. So recently we did develop a hepatitis C drug, and everybody knows hepatitis C is not an NTD, but the patients who suffer from it, they are a neglected population because of the stigma that is associated with hep C.
So let's talk about the neglected patients. Who are they?
The neglected patients would be, for our hepatitis C, it would be people who, you know, might be the LGBTQ community, or they might be people from, sharing of injectable drugs, you know.
So IVDU, yes. Intravenous drug users.
Yes, yes, of course. Yes. And so these are people that big pharma sometimes doesn't really necessarily want to allocate resources, you know, to develop drugs or to make it accessible for them, because they are normally at more marginalized areas where poverty is a bit more, you know, in evidence. So therefore, we came in, we stepped in, and we thought, okay, let's make these drugs for these people because they need a voice, they need a treatment, they need to carry on with life. Yeah.
Let's talk about neglected diseases. This is the first time I've heard of diseases being termed as such. What is neglected diseases?
Okay, so NTDs, a short form, we can use that, are tropical diseases, okay, that normally affect, I would say, the tropical climates of our world. So very prominent in areas like LATAM, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Colombia, those areas. And then we have some of them in India as well, quite a bit. And then majority of it is in Africa. They are parasitic diseases, basically. So they are vector-borne, some of them, and they can be passed around because infectiously lah.
For Malaysia, what would it be? Is it dengue? Is it something
yes,
else?
We have dengue only. We're very lucky. We don't have leishmaniasis. We do not have Chagas. We do not have the sleeping sickness. We do not have schistosomiasis. We are quite safe in that way. We only face dengue. Yes.
Okay. And why is dengue, I guess, termed as a neglected disease? Isn't dengue an endemic in Malaysia? Every Malaysian would probably know dengue. I met a few American friends. They don't know what dengue is all about. So I get that part. But in Malaysia, dengue is well known. Yeah. Why is it still being termed as neglected disease?
Yeah, so can I just maybe delve into my history a little bit?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So prior to this, this is a fundraising role, of course. Prior to this, I was a pharmacist in a government hospital for about 6 years, you know. And for 6 years of my life working in the healthcare line, for dengue, we have no solution for you. All we give you is normal saline, a little bit of paracetamol, and we look at your platelets, we look at your liver profile. So, you know, none of us, especially in Malaysia, ever wondered, why is there no antiviral for dengue? You know, you have it for the influenza, of course, you have a Tamiflu, you know. But for dengue, we don't really have
anything.
I thought
it's incurable, that's why.
No, actually, it It can be if resources are put towards it. I would possibly like to use the COVID-19 as an example. COVID-19 was something that nobody knew anything about, but the way resources were pulled together, especially from the global north, in order to come up with a vaccine at that speed, you know?
Yeah.
Right? From various pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, but it's while it is called novel coronavirus, yeah. We already have vaccines for H5N1, H1N1 yeah. and the likes. So it is a permutation to that particular effect.
Yeah.
So they did not, in a way, start from scratch. Do you feel that is the same case for dengue?
No, dengue research has been going on, just that not a lot of emphasis or not a lot of resources or funding has been going towards it. Mm. It's still been very limited. Mm. But now things have kind of changed because dengue, as we all know, is a climate-sensitive disease. Now, climate is all the rage right now. Everyone's talking about climate. WHO has also mentioned that they are anticipating a disease burden of dengue, malaria, chikungunya because of the El Nino effects for 2023 and 2024. Mm. And also, I think a lot of philanthropists globally have also come up and woken up because dengue has now reached the shores of France. It has gone to Spain. It has gone to a lot of, you know, developed nations and they are now waking up and realizing we do need a cure. Yeah.
Let's talk about the item that we spoke about right now. The Global North is not looking into dengue, largely because it's not affecting them.
Yes.
Do you feel that conversation needs to be brought to light? Folks like yourselves at DNDi and many more at these kind of events, that must be spoken of a lot more often now.
It should be spoken up, yes, because we have now the dengue vaccine from Takeda, which is really great. That is preventative, of course. What we are working on is a treatment, and they go hand in hand, preventative and treatment, of course. A lot more conversation has now started in the global north, of course, because in light of climate issues and in light of WHO also warning about dengue being very widespread, a lot of hospitals, even in the Middle East, in Yemen, in India, in Sri Lanka, they are all overloaded. For the first time, after COVID, we now understand what an overloaded hospital actually looks like.
Yeah.
You can picture it. You can picture beds filled.
Yeah.
Before this, a non-medical person would never understand. So now when I tell you, dengue is causing an overload in hospitals, beds to be taken, to be only given normal saline and paracetamol. It's so sad, you know?
It is.
It is very sad.
We'll go for one short break. When we come back, we'll discuss a bit more with the Neglected Diseases Initiative Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
Thanks for staying on with us. I have with me Roshwini Enfais Mutia. Enfais is a very interesting name. Let's talk about that just a bit. As I understand it, it sounds Gaelic.
Yes, it is Gaelic. It's Welsh. Yeah.
It's Welsh.
Yep. And it means rainbow in
oh,
Welsh.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Enfais.
Yeah.
Why would you have a?
Because my first name my first name means in Sanskrit light.
Okay.
So I guess light, the rainbow. Do you not feel I'm a
bubbly?
Ball of...
Yeah, you're a very bubbly person. Let's talk about the Southern.
So our Dengue Alliance.
Yeah, Dengue Alliance.
Right.
Sounds like a superhuman team, superhero team.
Yeah, we're making it sound really like a super sexy alliance that everybody wants to, you know, get into and evolve.
Yeah, yeah.
So our Dengue Alliance, okay, because we are a not-for-profit medical R&D, and we rely a lot on funding from governments and from private philanthropy and from, institutions. So we cannot do everything on our own. And we've also realized that why should, you know, the narrative be controlled by the global north? Even though we are headquartered in Geneva, we don't want to control the narrative. So with the Dengue Alliance, we want the global south countries, the south-south endemic dengue countries to take leadership and to, bring out their expertise and their skills for everyone to see. We are not capacity building. They have the skills. They have the capacity. We're just giving them that, you know, platform to do it. And it's really great because we brought Brazil, we brought Thailand, we brought India and Malaysia together, set them on a round table. Everyone's an equal and they have shared their expertise. India is super brilliant with their clinical work. Mahidol University in Thailand is like the John Hopkins of the, you know, of the
West. Of course, Mahidol.
They are very famous, you know, and their Prince Mahidol Award, which our founder actually won last year, Mr. Bernard. So they know us really well. In Brazil, we work with Fiocruz Foundation. They are also an R&D foundation, research-based, tied to the government. And in Sri Lanka, we have our head of dengue disease. So she's controlling the entire Dengue Alliance, Dr. Neelika. Mm. She is the dengue guru of the world, yes, I would say.
So is it fair to say that this Dengue Alliance is working hard to find an antiviral
treatment
to this?
Yes, that's what we're doing. But to be honest with you, we want to make it more sustainable, we want to reduce costs. We are repurposing drugs. There are a lot of antivirals out there, and we are doing it in such a way that we've got a list of a screening done on a couple of molecules of antivirals that have already been registered, and then we're just going to see which ones will work best for dengue. So we are repurposing, and that has brought down also the cost of the clinical research.
And what monetary impact are we looking at? Say, for instance, hepatitis C.
Yeah.
A drug that would normally cost 75,000, am I right?
Yeah.
You brought it down to 500 ringgit.
Yes, 75,000 USD actually. Yeah.
75,000 USD.
So about 300,000 ringgit, we have now managed to bring it down to 500 ringgit. Yes.
From 300,000 ringgit to 500 ringgit is phenomenal.
Monumental.
Monumental.
And we work so closely with Ministry of Health Malaysia. We're so happy that they have seen our, you know, they have seen the value added that we can bring to Malaysia, to the Southeast Asia region, and they are such, you know, they're very happy to partner with us on a lot of initiatives. Yeah.
So I understand the former DG of Health sits on your board.
Yes.
There's also collaborations with the Clinical Research Malaysia.
Yes, CRM Malaysia, with NIH Malaysia.
And how are these collaborations taking place? What kind of value do they bring to the table when it comes to collaborative purposes?
Right. Okay. So with the hepatitis C drug, we worked with the MOH Malaysia, with CRM as well, and then we also had a manufacturing partner in Egypt called Farco Pharmaceuticals. And then once the drug was established, it was developed. We then did an access strategy, and we worked on the policy and advocacy to get the drug registered in Malaysia. And then there was a tech transfer between Egypt and Malaysia. We partnered with Pharmaniaga, and Pharmaniaga then was the one producing the drug here.
How is this impacting Big Pharma with Gilead and many more? Are you guys in competition with each other?
I wouldn't say competition, but what I would say is that while they work for a different market, we work for a different market. And while their market may not necessarily cater to the global south, to the developing countries, so that's where we step in. So what we did was we managed to get a compulsory license, and we had to override their patent just to produce the DAA, the direct acting
agent.
Yeah, the direct acting antiviral. Yes.
Okay, so that's for hepatitis C.
Yeah.
What kind of work can we expect coming in for dengue, for instance?
Right, for dengue, we are doing our clinical work right now. Our partners are contributing as well in kind. Preclinical is being done in India, in Brazil, in Thailand as well. And we are also applying for funds together as well. So we work together in our fundraising collaborations, in our fundraising initiatives. We apply to places like MRC UK, to NIH in USA, USAID. Yeah, so that's what we're doing. And hoping that we will come up with a drug very soon that will be able to be used widespread in all these endemic dengue countries at a very low cost.
How can DNDi bring value to the society, considering that DNDi itself is part of the World Health Organization, based in Geneva? What kind of, conflicts of interest that you may have, or how is this collaboration with NIH or USAID or NHS, for instance, how does that all bring into the frame of you bringing value to Malaysia and the global south?
So just to correct you, WHO is a huge supporter. They were, huge contributors to it, but they don't really play that mega.
They're not a shareholder, basically. Yeah. Okay.
So we were a brainchild of MSF, Medicine Sans Frontières, and
Doctors Without Borders.
Doctors Without Borders in the US, right? And also our stakeholders, because we are not we are an NGO, because we have governments on our board. We have governments who are founders. We have Kenya's Camry, we have the MOH Malaysia, we also have Brazil's Fiocruz, they all were the founding members. So we work with multi-stakeholders.
So it's not
it's not against
to say, yeah
it's, we're not against governments, we're not, you know, we are not for profit, not an NGO. yes.
Okay, and based on this, I'm sure there's a lot of interests that needs to be upheld.
Yep.
How do you manage these different stakeholders and shareholders' interests,
yes,
and ensure that the best for the patients come forward ahead of all these other,
yes,
interests?
So, first of all, PDPs are something that is gaining a lot of traction right now. Actually, yesterday, PDP is a product development partnership.
Okay, pardon.
So,
okay.
Yeah, and so Dr. Rupa yesterday from UNESCAPE, I think, yes, UNESCAPE. So she mentioned that, you know, PDPs are the way forward in terms of having innovative financing, because it's very interesting how they manage the funding. You know, you have the product, it's right there, you know, it's tangible. And so with DNDI, our motto, we are PDP, and our motto is patients first. Every single thing we do is with our patients in mind, patients first. So we are very patient-centric.
Okay. And of course, your work is on fundraising.
Yep.
Let's talk about that part of your life, I suppose.
No one likes to talk about money.
No. I mean, after all, I'm a business journalist. We have to talk about money.
Yeah.
What would be some of the conversations that normally takes place when it comes to you asking for money from these family offices, from these philanthropic bodies, from the CSR corporates, arms, and many more?
Right.
What kind of questions do they ask, actually?
Yes, of course. So first of all, we like to do a lot of strategic work, meaning that we like to find people around the world who are very much interested in infectious disease, interested in global health, interested in climate-sensitive diseases, and then we start conversations with them. And so those kind of conversations are a little bit more, I suppose, structured easier because they have sort of a basis. But we also have non-medical related philanthropy or, you know, funders. And in that instances,
yeah, go on.
In that instances, we would actually talk to them about our portfolio, about the list of diseases that we work on, and then the drugs that we've already developed. We also have a pediatric portfolio as well. So we've made a 4-in-1 HIV drug for children in Africa. And so these are things that funders are very interested in. And then, of course, we have the actual budget of the whole entire project, how much it would cost, where the money is going, and we have an access plan as well, you know, so that it is accessible, it is made affordable for the lower middle-income countries.
Are they looking for profit when it comes to funding you guys?
No. There is no return, yes.
But how do they then justify to their own, I guess, shareholders that this money is going one way? It's not an investment, so to speak.
Yes, so I would possibly put it forth as, imagine in Malaysia, we have a lot of philanthropists funding building of hospitals, building of schools.
Yes.
So you then help the children, you then help the patients.
Yeah.
So think of our drug as a hospital. So our drug now makes it easier to cure certain diseases because when we first started, we were 20 years old, when we first started, we had a drug for sleeping sickness that was, you know, it was quite inhumane. It gave a lot of side effects and it was, you know, mass drug distribution, if you've ever heard before. And it kind of killed, like, you know, I'm not sure the statistics, maybe 1 in 20 people that it gave. And so when we stepped in, we came up with a more safer, more affordable, more easier drug to be taken, and it did the job.
And that is,
and it, yeah,
these kind of arguments are appealing for,
yes,
for philanthropic.
Yeah, yeah,
well,
because WHO wants to end NTDs by 2030. There is a road to elimination of neglected tropical diseases by 2030. And so we are part of that narrative.
That target is just, what, 7 years away?
Yes.
Is it still a lofty target to be upheld or is it achievable?
I think it's achievable because there are, if you have the statistics of it, which I can't pull offhand,
yeah, yeah,
there are some countries that have already eliminated certain diseases that we have worked on. And in 20 years, we have come up with 12 drugs. We have developed 12 medications for NTDs.
Do you feel that Malaysia is on its way to resolving or eradicating dengue altogether?
Yes, I am very, very positive about it because I see that the MOH Malaysia is absolutely very supportive. They are very proactive. And we have such brilliant researchers here, even in, you know, places like Sarawak General Hospital. You have amazing research facilities that, you know, worldwide recognize. The standards are amazing. We as Malaysians need to recognize that and we need to invest into our own country and we need to promote, you know.
So this has been going on for 3 days, the Asana Forum AVPN conference.
Yes.
What is your key takeaway from this, now that you've gone through these 3 days, you've met the necessary people that you need to meet, all the stakeholders, all the new contacts and collaborations that you can make? What are your takeaways from this particular conference? Did it meet that expectation that you had? Or did you come here with eyes wide open with no expectations?
I think I came with eyes wide open, no expectations, because it was my first AVPN. But as a prospect research person, I have to do my homework. So I had a list of people that I wanted to meet with you know, who they were, what they worked on. And I was really happy that we managed to meet most of the people that we wanted to meet. They were ever so humble. People here are happy to network, happy to talk to you, hear your story. But more than anything, my key takeaway is that there are funding gaps. There are funding gaps, especially in philanthropy and especially in climate-related issues that we all need to address. And while Asia may not be the biggest giver, you know, yet, I still think there's room for growth. There are many philanthropic circles from, you know, Lawrence Lian in Singapore. There's Dr. Roots, one in Hong Kong. And these are just going to grow ever more so. And more ultra-high net worth individuals are going to join these alliances, these circles, and pick up on initiatives that they actually want to support.
Did you speak to the money managers that are here as well? Folks from Dana Impact, Khazanah National, for instance, or all the other PE fund managers. Did you interact with them at all?
I did, but I must be honest, most of them are into impact investing and innovative investing, so meaning they would like a little bit of an ROI back. So the people that I speak to would be people, you know, in the foundation side, like, you know, even Yayasan Hasanah's foundation. We would look at Tanoto Foundation in Indonesia. You have YCAB from Indonesia as well. She's wonderful. Miss, what's her name? Vanessa, I think. Yes, very humble and down to earth. So these people are very much into giving. Giving to make the world a better place, as cliched as it sounds.
No, it's needed. Come on.
They're not expecting anything in return, because they, you know, have the resources and they know it is the gaps that they need to fill.
Okay. And of course, my final comment is this, or my final question to you is this. How has the way of your work changed following by attending these kind of conferences? Or is it more of just an eye-opener, and how you would structure your way of working is a little bit different moving forward?
It's going to be a lot different moving forward. I understand that now. Because while, you know, not for profits, we are very good at talking about our amazing product. But I think a lot more emphasis needs to be placed now on the impact of it, the social impact especially. What is it going to do for the country, for the nation, for the region, for the world? Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you very much. That was Roshini and Faiz Mutia. For now, this is me, Ibrahim Sani, signing off, not just from the KL Convention Centre, but Yayasan Hasanah Forum altogether. We'll be bringing you more of these conversations at the studio next week. My name is Ibrahim Sani. Catch you in the next one.